So, I will open the floor to anyone who has a question, a comment, an idea, whatever. Wow, good place to start. Nobody has anything on their mind. You're wide open. A tabla rasa. Anything I say will stick. Okay. I'll say something. You know, there's a lot packed into this little thing we did this morning. Could give a number of talks on this. But what does it mean to you when I say, with these 10 precepts, virtue becomes the vehicle for a happy existence? Through virtue, good fortune is attained, and virtue is the vehicle for liberation. We start with the first one. What does it mean to you when I say virtue becomes the vehicle for a happy existence? Feel free to call upon Shantideva, the Buddha, or your own practical experience. Or your knowledge of the way things tend to happen in the world. I say tend to, because they don't always, there are multiple factors involved.
I'll start.
Okay.
So the vehicle for a happy existence. I do feel that since I started following the precepts, that has come to pass. That my existence has been much more not just happy, but just all around better, which translates into happiness. Mm-hmm. But quite a change. Quite
and
a big change.
What do you attribute that to? Magic?
No.
or causes and conditions that you can see and recognize and explain?
Yes. Yes, the causes and conditions.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Some people would say it's due to magic. If you do good things will happen to you, and the good things that happen to you will make you happy. Anybody ever heard that theory? Oh, come on. Everybody's heard that theory. It's been popular for thousands of years. There's a magical power in performing good acts. Give away money and you'll win the lottery or something. Except that since it doesn't always happen, sometimes you have to wait for a lifetime or two before it happens. But according to Jessica, this has absolutely nothing to do with that, right?
Right.
What does Shantideva have to say about this?
One of the main things I remember him saying is that all of our happiness comes from thinking of other people, and all of our unhappiness comes from thinking about ourselves.
Yes, that is such a pithy, deeply true statement. Actually, I've never bothered to
go to the Sanskrit.
Is this cutting in and out? Well, okay, I might have to do something. Let me finish what I was saying and move this as close to my mouth as I can. There. And I'll change the battery if it's necessary. I've never checked the actual Sanskrit and translated it myself. But the of the various translations I've seen, the one that struck me most and that I remembered best is that all the happiness in the world is ultimately due to caring for others and being concerned for their well-being. All of the unhappiness in the world is due to being concerned with our own happiness, satisfying our own needs and looking after our own well-being.
So I would be interested in the translation if it is for caring for other people or others' beings, because I feel like being concerned for trees and water and birds and other beings other than people isn't a huge thing for us right now in this time.
Yeah. Knowing where what Shanti Deva was talking about and and the Dharma in general, I'm sure the word that was being used there was sattva, and it means all beings, all sentient beings, which is an important thing. On the other hand, and this is not something you'll find in anybody's scriptures, scriptures consist of the sutras as they've been preserved and the commentaries on them. But my observation is that humans are prone to more and deeper suffering than other kinds of beings. And I'll have to explain that, but it goes back to the distinction between the different kinds of suffering that the Buddha made and the expression of the First Noble Truth. Physical pain is universal, and it's the nature of life, eat and be eaten. There's a lot of physical pain with organisms in nature. But the Buddha made the distinction between the physical pain that is inevitable for creatures like ourselves and like all of the other beings that we're aware of on this planet, and very well probably true for the beings that, for whatever reasons, we're not aware of in some sense. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that the term sentience really means capable of experiencing pain or pleasure. That's probably how I'd define sentience. And although some schools of thought would exclude plants from that, my observation, plants can experience pain and pleasure too. So I think Shanti Deva was referring to all beings, but I think in that we have to keep in mind that the second kind of suffering, the suffering generated by the mind, human beings have a kind of mind capable of generating incredibly more suffering than even our closest animal relatives that I know of. You know, right? Most animals, as far as we can tell, probably don't spend much time thinking about their own death, but we're quite aware. Good morning. We're quite aware of what awaits us in the future in terms of sickness, old age, and death. We're capable of desires and aversions that go beyond many other kinds of organisms. We're capable of the existential question of what is this all about, and seeing that the nature of this world is suffering. So although Shanti Deva, I think, was referring to all beings, I think we, practically speaking, should recognize that there is a different kind of suffering that human beings are subject to. And there is so much of it surrounding us. So we should be, you know, let's go back to the original saying. Did I answer that question adequately? Yeah. He means both, but other human beings do deserve more attention, and the fact is that we are in more of a position to affect the suffering of human beings around us more often. So, yeah. So Shantideva was, what he was pointing out, it really cuts to the root of the Dharma, that if we believe we are a separate self, that we crave in the form of desire and aversion, and that desire and aversion means that we suffer. So when he says that all of the suffering in the world, and here, recall, he's not talking about pain, he's talking about mental suffering. All the mental suffering in the world is due to trying to take care of ourselves, looking after our own happiness, protecting ourselves, because we're seeing ourselves as separate. Well, no, did I? I'm having one of those brain glitches days. Did I get this right? Okay, yeah, all the unhappiness in the world is due to that. Okay, so through our own craving and self-attachment, we make ourselves suffer. That was the second noble truth, is that all of our suffering is due to craving, which is due to self-attachment. And also, there is so much suffering in the world, experienced by other humans and experienced by beings of every sort, that happens for exactly the same reason, because of our attachment to self and our attempts to satisfy our cravings. So when he says all of the suffering in the world, both in terms of you as the individual I'm speaking to, and just all the suffering that's there everywhere is due to taking care of us and being worried about taking care of this self that we believe we are. And then the second thing he says is that all the happiness in the world is due to caring for the well-being of others. And there's something there, there's two things there. One, just as with the other, it has both this, the effect on us personally and the amount of happiness there is in the world in general. How do you feel when you do something that's helpful to somebody else? You know, okay, I'll leave an extra $5 tip, but boy, does that ever hurt. I'll give somebody a hand when they need it, but boy, is that ever painful. Then you feel miserable afterwards, right? If somebody's unhappy, I'll let them cry on my shoulder. Boy, does that make me miserable. No. The fact is that a lot of the things we do to make ourselves happy don't work out, or they disappoint us. For the amount of time and effort we put into doing that thing, it doesn't give us the satisfaction that we expected. But it's never the case when you try to help somebody else. As a matter of fact, even if it doesn't work out as well as you'd hoped, you know, takes us back to the examples of there are people we try to help, but due to their own deep-seated problems, they don't take advantage of the help, and they use it in some other way. or they refuse to accept it or anything else, we still feel good about the fact that we tried. So looking after the well-being of other beings, I mean, how do you feel when you a bird flies into a window and you pick it up and you hold it and you protect it until it's able to fly away again? Or you feed a hungry cat or something like that. But the other thing, of course, is you're also spreading happiness around while you're doing this. So virtue becomes the vehicle for a happy existence. If you follow the precepts, so Shantideva is one illustration of that. But if you follow the precepts, there's all kinds of other things. If you follow the precepts, you reduce the number of situations that you create for yourself that are going to land on your head later on, right? And if you practice right speech, right action, and right livelihood, what is the reaction of other people around you going to be? You are going to be, in general, better liked, more trusted. Other people are going to be more willing to lend you a hand when you need it, so on and so forth. So there's that simple kind of causality as well. So practicing virtue in all of its different forms contributes to our happiness. If you practice the virtue of telling the truth on your income tax form, you never need to worry about getting that letter from the IRS that says that we're going to come examine your records for the last 7 years. You just say, okay, I got them. I didn't keep them in order, so have fun. All kinds of things like that. So what about through virtue, good fortune is attained? Yes. Pass the microphone back.
A quick question about that Shantideva quote, which, like many of those things, is pithy and profound. But if I were to, like, post that on Facebook, right, which doesn't really get any of the depth of explanation that's there.
Right.
Because on the surface, it seems like a beautiful thing.
It's like just one of those nice things that people say.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm, because I work with so many, like, junior high school age, you get about that long to communicate some message. Like, so, there seems like there's some risk of somebody reading it who already has a predilection toward self-deprecation to read that and say, oh, that means I should do things for others to my own detriment even, and yes, expect that I'll be,
I should lay down and let people
happy.
Walk over me.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And people play on it, and sometimes they say, yeah, you know, this is, the virtue will make you happy, so give me all your money and the virtue of doing that. So what do we do about that? How do we address that? And how does that reflect on this as a, on the validity of, or not the validity, there's no question of validity, on the value of repeating Shantideva and on the value of communicating to other people this idea that if you want to be happier, be virtuous.
And the one thing that I did like is the translation that you shared was a little more elaborate, but it spoke a little bit more to talking about sort of the greater suffering or the greater happiness, which makes it a little bit less like I should take it all on myself.
Yeah.
But it almost seems that maybe in some context, like some sort of retranslation that addresses a more contemporary, I mean, it's not a global issue, but it is. You know,
well, it's actually a pretty big issue. There are a lot of people out there with low self-esteem. And there are a lot of people with various kinds of guilt complexes. And I don't need to do it, but any one of the psychologists in our Sangha, and we have an unusual number of them, could give us a list of the reasons why somebody... So you've raised a very good point. There's quite a few people out there who would and actually do misunderstand a lot of these ideas and feel like, you know, that they feel like the idea of giving up attachment to self means treating themselves as though they have no value. So that's, I don't know that there's a way that you could retranslate Shantideva that can address that, or restate what we've stated here that could address that. What it means, I think, is, well, it reminds us, first of all, that this is profound wisdom we're talking about. And if we throw these statements out to the world at large, most of them will fall on barren ground. Oh, that's a nice thought, and it's gone. But some of them are going to fall in places, well, of course, some of them are going to fall in places where, oh yeah, that makes sense, and you know, and they want to know more and understand it better. But if you just broadcast it to the world, some of it's going to fall in places where it ends up doing more harm than good. And so that's the problem with profound truth, is that profound truth is easily misunderstood, and the results aren't always neutral, sometimes they're negative. So what it means is we have to be careful, and we have to take that into account. Now, what would be another profound truth that we could couple with this that would resolve the problem? I can't, there's lots of them. You're a child of the universe. You have as much right to be here as anybody else. You have as much, you know, we say, may all beings be free from suffering. We don't say, except for me. May all beings be free, filled with loving kindness, except for me. May all beings be happy, except for me. The idea of, and this goes back, we have to be very, very careful talking about egolessness and no self, because most people will misunderstand that. Yeah. So, and those who are prone to it will say, I better walk, lay down, let you walk all over me. So we have to, if we're going to start bringing up profound truths, then we're going to have to bring up a little more to help people understand that. Selflessness means that you don't set yourself apart from everybody else. And if you don't set yourself apart on it from everybody else, you see yourself as valuable. The analogy that I think works best for this is that a person who understands sees themselves and the other person or persons in the same way a mother would see her children, and the body and mind of that person is one of the children on the same and receives the same care, love, affection, value, everything else as the rest. And so that needs to be communicated that because one of the conceits that is spoken of is, in addition, I mean, usually when we say conceit, we mean we think we're better than somebody else. But it's also a conceit to think that you are less deserving than anyone else. And that's a conceit that a lot of people entertain. It's a way of strengthening the sense of self. I am this unique separate self. And I know I'm a unique separate self because I'm rotten and everybody else isn't. So, you're absolutely right. We have to say more than just that in terms of spreading it around. How is virtue a vehicle for liberation? Does that make any sense to you? If we go around keeping the precepts, that means that someday when we're handing a beggar a dollar on the street, that all of a sudden we're awakened? Yes.
I'm still fairly new to most of these ideas, but reading Thich Nhat Hanh about the interbeing of all the eight of the noble path,
yes.
The Eightfold Path, and if following the precepts, I know it certainly addresses right view, and I can't think of the others. But I'm sure it addresses at least some of the others. And if they are all interconnected, then we're addressing some. We're also indirectly addressing all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would then be a vehicle towards that.
It is. But this particular statement is probably the deepest of all of these. It's worth going into.
Which particular statement?
That virtue is the vehicle for liberation. What is liberation? What liberation are we referring to? We're referring to the liberation that comes through awakening. What is awakening? Awakening is the overcoming of craving and the realization of no self, right? So what this is saying is virtue is the vehicle for liberation from the delusion that leads to our suffering. So it's liberation from suffering, but liberation from suffering only comes through wisdom. And it brings with it compassion. So we're being, you know, virtue is the vehicle for liberation from delusion, craving, the suffering it brings, and it transforms us into a being of wisdom and compassion. That makes it a really deep statement, doesn't it? Now, how does virtue do that? Now, here, let's talk about what virtue is. What's the difference between virtue and morality or ethics? Or rule following in general?
Virtues would be behavioral.
The
other concepts would be concepts.
Would be what?
Concepts.
They're
part of the theory.
That's right. They're conceptual. Behavior flows out of, you know, morality usually comes from, there's some source, typically divine, of morality, and some reward or punishment that's associated with how well we keep to that. Ethics are rules made by men, women, people. They're rules made by people, and the purpose is to allow things to work better, and hopefully to, in their best form, to make this a better world. But even when not in their best form, ethics, the purpose of ethics is to make things work. I don't know if there's any lawyers in the room, but most people do not think highly of lawyers because of some of the things that they're called upon to do in the course of fulfilling their ethical requirements. They have ethical requirements that have a positive effect, but they also have an ethical requirement to do anything in their power to ensure that their client wins, which leads them to do things which are not prohibited by their professional ethics. And of course, we as non-lawyers look at it and say, what scumbag hired guns these are, who find these devious methods of manipulating the legal system so that the bad and the wealthy get off and the good and the honest become victimized. But ethics are rules. And then let's go to just rules in general. Like, virtue is different from all of these. What do we mean when we talk about a person having a virtue? This person has the virtue of blah, blah, blah. We're talking about a personality characteristic. We're talking about a trait. We're talking about a behavioral characteristic that constitutes a part of the person, right? That's what we mean by a virtue. And when we talk about practicing virtue, we're talking about changing the traits that make us up. That's where this starts to really get deep. And now we can see, if we follow this up, we'll be able to see how it's connected to liberation. Because otherwise, how could being good, not being bad, following the rules, lead to liberation from delusion and the end of suffering, wisdom, and compassion? It's because practicing virtue isn't just following rules. Practicing virtue is changing the set of personality traits that make us up at the deepest level. So, if we look at what it means to practice virtue, it means, well, first of all, let's look at our motives for non-virtuous behavior. Motives for non-virtuous behavior are selfish, right? We want something for ourselves, or we want to avoid some problem. Do you agree? So non-virtuous behavior comes from our belief in ourself as a separate entity. It comes from our selfishness directly, and it manifests through desire and aversion. If you look at all the things that are called virtue, including right thought and intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, if we look at why we do knowingly do these things, we're not counting anything that you do that you don't know that there's a problem with it. But anytime you intentionally engage in something that would be considered non-virtuous, it's because you've succumbed to the attachment to self. And every time you do that, you make that stronger. In other words, you've made yourself more non-virtuous. Every time the temptation arises to act out of selfishness, and you do so, and you don't do so, I'm sorry, I'm losing track again. Every time the temptation arises and you deny it, you set it aside, you decline, what you're doing is now you're creating virtue. You're altering yourself. You're altering your personality characteristics. The more often you do that, the easier and more natural it becomes to do that, until you become a virtuous person. Virtuous in what way? Virtuous in the sense that you have much less self-attachment. The practice of virtue by itself isn't usually enough to lead to awakening. But I think in some cases it does. I think we can look at some people, and I wouldn't be surprised if all of you can't think of at least one person who just always acts in a very virtuous way, always caring, always loving, always non-selfish, who sets their own desires aside for the sake of others, and who just naturally doesn't have to struggle with irritation and aversion and things like that. There are these fortunate, blessed people around. You know some? So this is what we're working towards, and you can be that way, but we practice virtue in order to move ourselves in that direction. Every time we deny craving, every time we deny desire because we can see that it's going to have some kind of harmful consequence. I mean, denying desire doesn't mean that if you feel like having a dish of vanilla ice cream with chocolate chips, and it's not going to hurt you, you don't do this 4 times a day every day, you're not 200 pounds overweight, it's not somebody else's ice cream, you know. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's those other times when we act out of desire, knowing that it's actually going to have a harmful result. And what we're doing is we're reinforcing desire and self-attachment. So this is how virtue transforms us. So this is how virtue is the vehicle for liberation. It's not the only vehicle. We require meditation and insight, deep understanding. We require study of the Dharma and integration of that information in order to guide us, in order to point us in the right direction. But virtue is the vehicle for liberation, because if you only practice meditation, your chances of awakening through meditation alone are limited, and the kind of liberation that you will achieve will likewise be limited. You can awaken to the truth of no self, but carry within you all of these habits of behavior from your past. So you're still, even though you know you aren't a separate self, you still act like a separate self, and you keep catching yourself, and you have to do the work then that you didn't do before. It's still there remaining to be done. So anyway, that's what you get for not coming and leaving it up to me to bring up a topic. So I finished talking about what I brought up, so I'm happy to hear what anybody else would like to say.
Well, I have a question about your, maybe you were just being facetious about protecting the bird or feeding the hungry cat. But the fact is, I can see both sides of that. My own knee-jerk response would be to protect the bird and keep the cat away.
Of course.
But
I wasn't suggesting you feed the bird to the cat.
Well, but but if the cat was really hungry, I mean, that's my question. That's my question.
Okay.
Would that not be as much a service to the cat?
It would be. And you would be the one who would have to make the decision. And whether you became more virtuous as a result of feeding the bird to the cat or less virtuous would depend on your understanding of the consequences of the act. And if you sincerely believed that it was that all things considered, taking everything into account, the net result of feeding the bird to the cat would be for the greatest good and the greatest happiness. In other words, if you felt like that was an act, we're going back to Shanti Deva here, that was an act that you were performing for the benefit of other beings, then it would be virtuous. And somebody else standing next to you might be horrified. Mm-hmm. And chances are they would be. And that would be one of those instances where you might feel good about having done what you feel is a virtuous act. And even though by somebody else's interpretation, it might not have been virtuous. If your intention, it's your intention that counts. Remember, that's what the Buddha, when the Buddha realized that magical explanations didn't work, You know, when he realized the nature of dependent arising, he threw magic out of the window. And part of the magic he threw out of the window was the pre-existing notion that good acts in themselves magically lead to other good acts. He said, karma is intention. So it's the karma behind your act. And there can be unintended consequences. And maybe the person that abhorred what you did might have a conversation with you after. And they might that indeed what you had done was what you should have done, right? And you might feel really bad about that. And you might learn from it and say, okay, from now on, no more feeding injured birds to cats. I'll find another way to solve the cat's problem. Every step of that process would have been virtuous. Even though you see your act in a different light, you learn from it. You grew from it. It doesn't change the nature of the intention that was behind it. And it actually works the other way, too. Even, this is the more common situation, is that you perform an act that is rooted in craving and selfishness, even though you know you shouldn't. If afterwards you feel sincere remorse and regret, if there is any way that you can make compensation for what you've done, I mean, if you fed a bird to a cat selfishly, maybe that's not a good example, but we do all kinds of things selfishly, and then afterwards we realize, oh, that was a selfish act, and I really shouldn't have done that. I wasn't keeping the precepts. I wasn't living the Dharma the way I meant to. If you feel sincere remorse, if you take action to make right to whatever degree you can what you did wrong, if you form a really strong, deep resolve to try to do better next time, and then you see the trouble with forming resolves, it's like heroin addiction. Heroin addicts resolve all the time not to do this anymore. You've got to do more than have regret and resolve, because we're addicted to our selfish behavior. There's one more step you have to take, which is to practice in a way, in the ways that are going to help you to overcome this tendency, which means to practice the Dharma. And this is something that is usually called in the Mahayana, it's called the Four Powers. You regret, you do whatever you can to to correct or make resolve your wrongdoing. Okay, so regret, maybe we should call that resolution, because the next one is the resolve not to do it anymore. That's the third power. That's where you make good karma. The good karma you make is by saying, I am going to do everything I can not to do this anymore. And then the fourth power is resorting to the one certain method we know, which is the study and practice of the Dharma, which will keep you from doing those sorts of things in the future. Now, anytime we start talking about precepts and virtue, every conversation I've ever had, I remember giving a talk at University of the West, and one of the students in the graduate program in Buddhism starts coming up examples of, well, what if such and such, you know, would you tell the truth then? What if such and such, would you take something that was not freely given? I mean, somebody, you know, well, there was an example just this last week, the fellow that shot those 9 people in the church. The week before, one of his friends stole his .45 automatic. Unfortunately, he got it back. But, you know, whenever you talk about virtue, everybody's going to try to come up with these situations that make the precepts wrong. Like, would it be wrong? Or somebody's, you're in a position to kill a person who is just about to kill 100 other people. I mean, this is from one of the Jataka tales, right, where Buddha's on a ship and pirates had taken over it. And, you know, that's why one of the things you have to realize is that acts in themselves are just acts. They are nothing more than that. They have consequences that are good or bad, but we're limited in our ability to accurately foresee the consequences. And sometimes feeding the injured bird to the cat might actually produce better consequences in the long run than not. And but the fact is that we often don't know. As a matter of fact, we rarely know the ultimate consequence of our acts, good or bad. But acts themselves in a sense are neutral. It's their consequences that makes an act good or bad. But in terms of virtue, in terms of the effect it has on the person who does the act, it's in the intention. And this is what the Buddha realized that nobody before him had really put together, is that he said, when I say karma, I mean intention. You are the result of your karma. You are born of your karma in every moment. You are the inheritor of your karma. And by karma, he meant intention. You create yourself. And that's what it's about. So we make mistakes. Another metaphor I like to use to help reinforce this is we take ourselves back to the 1890s in Austria. There's a pregnant woman on the street. There's a runaway carriage about to run her down, which would probably kill her and the child that she's bearing. And so a virtuous person pulls her out of the way, thereby saving the life of the child who will grow up to be Adolf Hitler. Right? You cannot know the ultimate consequences of your actions. You can only know your intentions. And your intentions require you to make the best possible prediction you can of your actions.
There's a story about the Dalai Lama with the impossible, you know, virtue scenario, you know, where there's a terrorist with his button, with his thumb on the, you know, the button for a nuclear bomb, and, you know, you're the only one in a position to stop him and shoot him. You know, would you do it? And apparently the Dalai Lama responded, "I'll let you know when it happens."
Yeah, right. That's right. And that is the best possible answer to all of these what if situations, you know. And if it hasn't already, I'm sure it's already happened to any of you that discuss the Dharma. You've always got somebody that's trying to come up with some exception, and that's the best possible answer, is say, "I'll decide when it happens," because it's going to depend on so many circumstances. So. And the Dalai Lama might have said, "Well, I would do this or I wouldn't do that," but he doesn't know, and he knows he doesn't know, and he knows that there's no point in trying to guess today what he would do in that actual situation.
And I imagine in one of those impossible situations, if you didn't have time to think, you would just act.
That's right.
But that action would only be informed by
exactly
what level of virtue you've practiced.
That is exactly right, and that's extremely important. The fact is, one of the delusions that we live in is that we go through our daily lives deciding what we do and doing it on purpose. And one of the things that happen when you become mindful is that, no, most of your life is on automatic pilot. Most of the decisions you make, most of the words that come out of your mouth, most of your emotional reactions are conditioned. They're the kind of habitual karma that you have created. And the good thing about mindfulness, or having somebody else pointing out your failures in this way, is that it gives you the opportunity to change that personality trait. But yeah, we operate mostly on automatic pilot, even when we think we're making decisions, because we're in a situation and a thought comes up and another thought comes up and we say we've decided. Well, there's been a consensus of unconscious sub-minds that, and the decision that they make and that they project into your consciousness is a reflection of how you have conditioned yourself in the past. And so when you find yourself behaving in these ways, then that's what, then it tells you that's what you've got to work on. Yeah, good, good point, yeah. What happens in the moment, you might not know till after the fact, after you've either pushed the button or not pushed the button, right? I thought it was cool in the Batman movie, I guess it was the second one. I don't know why I watched this, but absolutely ridiculous movie. But the coolest part of the whole movie is the Joker had loaded all the New York ferries. Everybody's trying to escape from New York because they told him that they're going to blow up the bridges and he was going to take over New York. So everybody's packed onto these ferries, and then the ferry engine stops and he tells everybody that the hold is the engines are destroyed, they can't move, the hold is completely filled with explosives, they look in a particular box and there's a detonator button, except that the detonator button will blow up the other ferries. And so if they blow up the other ferries first, then they can't push the button that blows them up. Right? That was the situation in the movie. Crazy movie. And I totally understand if you've never seen it, because I don't know why it's the way I thought. But I was struck by that part because the Joker was so disappointed that nobody blew up anybody else. So you don't know till it happens. Anyway.
So don't press the button, right?
Well, you don't know till it happens, but you make the best decision you can.
I just wanted to say about the person in the audience who asked the question about, well, the impossible virtue situation or scenario.
Yeah.
I think it's because they have somewhere in them, they have a deep-seated recognition that it's not just about the rule. And that's what they're trying to get spoken. And so if they're hearing it spoken, that sounds like it's just about the rule, it's just don't kill, or it's just don't steal, then some part of that person feels like that's not enough. And so they have to bring this out and say, but wait. I could think of a scenario where it would be appropriate to kill, or I can think of a scenario where it would be appropriate to steal. So if you're telling me that this is all just about keeping that rule absolutely, then I can, even if I may not know what the right answer is, I can tell that what you're giving me is wrong. And so then I'm going to not listen, basically, for the rest of it, unless you can flesh it out for me in a better way.
Yeah. And this is it shows an interesting thing that's happened in our world, because religions all provide this kind of morality that is rule-based, and more people are rejecting that. I think as human beings, we're not biologically different than people were a thousand years ago in the Middle Ages, or a few thousand years ago. But we've evolved culturally, and most importantly, our level of education and critical thinking and things like that. And I agree with you. It's not just the students in the University of the West class. It's a lot of people in the world who are questioning this idea of absolute rule following. And of course, it's had a backlash. So now we've got a whole lot of people who are just totally adamant that it's following the rules to the letter, and it doesn't matter the situation, it doesn't matter the harm that it causes to others, that it doesn't matter the increase in the suffering and misery in the world. What follows is following God's law, or following what Allah laid down through Muhammad, or anywhere you want to look. And so what we're seeing in the world is, and I think it's a result of education, I think it's a result of cultural evolution, is that more and more people are recognizing that rules are good, but rules are limited, and there needs to be something much, much deeper. Because it doesn't take a very bright person at all to think of situations where the rule doesn't make sense. But unfortunately, we've got people that they're determined that it's the rule and only the rule that counts, no matter the scenario that you create for them. No matter that the harm that it causes to society as a whole. They just, or the world as a whole, the planet as a whole, but, you know, and that's the real tragedy.
I think it can backlash the other way, too, which is that for the people who reject the rule following, it can be an over-rejection to say, well, then there's no value ever to rules or virtue, and I basically should just do whatever I can to get away with as much as I can in order to have, you know, to feed. If I'm going to reject the rules of the church, for example, then I'll swing to the extreme of a selfish, totally selfish model, where I just take care of myself only.
Well, there are, I think maybe what you're referring to, these are people that have always been around. And I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that more people are questioning divinely dispensed morality or anything like that. There have always been people who were skeptical that there really is any moral basis for anything at all. And there have always been people who, due to their upbringing and their own personal experiences, don't know anything other than selfishness. There are children that have grown up in poverty in the ghettos, and they end up in these gangs, and they've never had much opportunity in their life to learn the opposite. And there are people who have grown up with so much wealth, so much incredible wealth and luxury, and are aware of the degree that is supported by the exploitation of others in virtual slavery. Well, there was a time in this country where people grew up in wealth knowing that there were actual slaves out there creating their wealth. And this too encourages selfishness. So there have always been people who have been prone to selfishness. There's an interesting thing. One of the things that we always worry about is that atheists and materialists are going to be the ones that we talk about in this regard. And it seems logical, right? Does it seem logical to you that atheist would be the person who doesn't see any point in doing anything except what's going to satisfy their needs and take care of themselves? How many of you have, to you, that seems logical? It does seem logical. It's not borne out by history. If you look at the people that have been behind the major transformations that have happened in human society, the number of atheists amongst them is outstanding. There's many very religious people as well, but they're actually outnumbered. As far as I can tell, they're outnumbered considerably by self-professed atheists. So, and this goes to something else. I think part of our nature, human nature, is in fact selfishness. We're programmed to be selfish, and we're programmed to act out of craving. But we are also part of human nature. We are also programmed to be generous, to behave altruistically in certain circumstances, to be loving and kind. This is just as much a part of human nature as the other. As a matter of fact, I won't go in. It would be tedious to go into it. But when you examine the way natural selection works, it works on small percentages. And so when you have a situation where there are two characteristics, they're very often two characteristics that are preserved in a population over very long periods of time. They're often very, very closely balanced. So, you know, something has to work. If something works better than something else, even by in 1 or 2% of the cases, over a long enough period of time, over enough generations, it becomes strongly dominant in the population. But there are other things that remain in balance. And I find that the tendency to selfishness, the natural, innate, inborn tendency to selfishness and craving, and the other natural, inborn, innate tendency to selfless caring, that these two are, they tend to be very, very closely balanced with each other, and that nurture and environment plays a huge role in shifting one way or the other. So that points the finger towards a huge social problem that needs to be recognized and addressed, because we live in a society. We live in a materialistic, capitalist, consumer society that is based on the assumption that human nature is greed and aversion. And therefore, the only way to control human nature is to manipulate people through greed and aversion, and that's the world that we live in. And yet, as a social problem, think of the change that could happen if I'm right and these two tendencies are so closely balanced. Think of what would happen if the basis of our culture, of our social structure, didn't assume selfishness, but rather assumed mutual caring and selflessness. In other words, shifted the balance a little bit the other way. People wouldn't stop being selfish, by and large, in the world, but they might be a lot less selfish, and society as a whole would move in a really positive direction. And so I see that we can change ourselves. And some people believe that we can, but we can change ourselves. We can overcome the selfish tendencies that our culture has reinforced in us. And this is the whole part of the Dharma. And really, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all go out there and find ways to move people to the other side of that line, so that the other aspect of human nature. And I kind of see the awakenings of that coming. It's interesting how disaster and catastrophe sometimes bring out the best in people, right? More and more people are realizing that we're in the middle of a disaster, an incredible catastrophe. You probably all are aware of Pope Francis encyclical, 198 pages long or something like that, that he released last week. It's worth looking at if you're not. It's really worth, you don't need to read the 198 pages. Just read what people have to say about it and summarize it. And he's pointing to exactly this. He's saying the world needs to make exactly this shift, and I agree with him totally. And if you really, as a Buddhist, if you have any notion at all of the bodhisattva ideal, of bodhicitta, of the desire to reduce the suffering and eventually eliminate the suffering of all beings, then the most powerful thing that you could do is to set yourself to trying to shift our cultural values away from the negative side of human nature towards the positive side. And I don't know how to do it, and Pope Francis didn't spell out how to do it either, but boy did he ever spell out the direction that we need to go clearly. He clearly defined the problem, and he clearly pointed the direction we need to go. So, somebody must have to go to the bathroom by now. So that's enough for today.